Welcome to University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. When a theater organist launched into a film, you could smell popcorn and feel the excitement in the air. We're talking about silent films, of course, which, as it turns out, weren't silent at all. They had music all the way through them. Often live music played by an organist who represented every frame of the action and introduced all the characters and their emotions. Well, it's an art form that's had a resurgence of a sort in the past several decades. And one of its leading practitioners of today was with me recently in Madison's Capitol Theater, sitting at the Grand Barton organ. His name is Jelani Eddington. It started out with Nickelodeons, in which one viewer would view one very short film, but somewhere along the line that turned into a theater experience.
Right, and a lot of that evolution was driven by technology. As Hollywood figured out how to do more things on screen and where, you know, how to use that technology, so too grew the motion picture industry. And it was wonderful to see that evolution from, as you say, the original Nickelodeons to having literally a theater, a movie palace, if you will, on every corner in every city in America.
And there was a whole galaxy of little movie studios around the country. We're talking about 1920, 1925. And one of the more remarkable ones, by today's standards certainly, was the Norman Studios down in Arlington, Florida. How did that come about?
Well, the Norman Studios is a really interesting story behind that, and that sort of brings us into the picture that we're going to look at a little bit today. But one of the things that Richard Norman was really interested in doing was portraying African Americans in film. And that was something that at that time in the 1920s, portrayals of African Americans were oftentimes full of a lot of regrettable stereotypes and typecasting, if you will, and he really wanted to do something completely different from that. He wanted to show the very rich history of African Americans and using African American actors and to portray them in a very positive way. And that's something that was not only unique for the time, but very refreshing to see.
And in this era of notable films, some of which we remember today, where is the position of these films that Norman Studios produced?
Well, as we look back on that history, the film, particularly The Flying Ace, that we're going to see a little bit of in just a few minutes, really stands out as one of his notable films. And it's just, again, as I said a few moments ago, it's great to be able to bring that to life, not just to see it, but then from, you know, my perspective as an accompanist, to be able to try to lend music to it and bring it to, you know, bring it back to life in a musical way as well.
Well, in this instance, and we'll get into it a little bit more later, you're more than an accompanist, you're the composer of this entire film score, minus the parts provided by Rachmaninoff and Schubert, which are kind of hardwired into the film in some cases.
Right, and that's one of the things that is really both challenging and also gratifying as a scorer for film, is that the job of the musician is to take a picture that's just moving pictures, if you will, and bring it to life through the use of music. And if even thinking about that in modern terms, if you go to the movies today, if you stripped away the musical score, you'd be left with just a skeleton, really. You'd be left with a shell of what you get in the final result. And that was very much true, in fact, even more true in the 1920s when this art form was developing, because there was, in the absence of the musical background, there was no music, no sound at all. And one of the most important jobs of the organist as the composer, as the accompanist, is to select music, either through composition or compiling existing pieces of music that not only match what's going on the screen, but also reinforces it and helps to bring it to life to make it a positive experience for the viewer.
Kind of gives the viewer an emotional cue often.
Absolutely it does. And it's the same way that we relate to music in films today. You often think about a scary sequence or something where you can feel your heart start to pound in your chest. That's a lot of times driven by musical cues in the film, and it's exactly the same role that you would take toward with a film from the 20s.
Now, some of those techniques, of course, go all the way back to opera. For example, there would be a leitmotif to establish a particular character. Is that the sort of thing you would do with silent film music?
That's very much the sort of thing. And in fact, one of the most powerful tools that you have as an accompanist is to pick some sort of theme. Sometimes it's a very short theme, maybe just a few notes. Other times it may be a longer, more developed theme. And use that to cue, to signal, if you will, to the viewer that this is related to a particular character. So if you've done your job well, then just by hearing that music, the viewer knows that this is going to be maybe the villain's theme, or maybe the hero's theme, or the love interest theme. And as that recurs throughout the film, it really reinforces that association with the audience.
So who's the hero in The Flying Ace? Introduce him to us with his leitmotif.
Sure. So the hero in The Flying Ace is a gentleman by the name of William Stokes. And at the very beginning of the film, we will hear this motif. And then throughout the film, in various scenes where he is playing an important role, you'll hear it again. And that theme sounds like this.
Well, as long as you've introduced our hero, why not just launch us into the film and we'll meet some of our other major characters and see how it all comes together at the beginning of The Flying Ace.
That sounds like fun.
The Flying Ace, produced by Norman Studios, Arlington, Florida. Entire cast composed of colored artists. Mayport. A little station on the main line of M, N, and O Railroad. It is here that passengers change for the eastern branch of the road. Number 9 left only one passenger this sunny morning. Blair Kimball, paymaster of the MNO Railroad, played by Boise DeLeggi. Thomas Sawtell, station master in Mayport, played by George Colvin. I'm surprised to see you here today. You ain't due until tomorrow. Dr. Maynard, the local dentist, played by Sam Jordan. Finley Tucker, local aviator, who has a mysterious source of income, played by Harold Platts. All of it. Jed Splivens, local constable. He meets all trains in the hope of arresting some petty offender, played by Lyons Daniels. Kimball isn't due until tomorrow. Wonder if he's got payroll in that satchel. Hardly. He hasn't got his guards along today.
Packing a lot of introductions into a fairly short space there, musically.
There are about four main characters that we see in the first minute and a half of the film.
Well, you have quite the instrument to work with here. The Grand Barton organ, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the relatively few in the country, and its original theater location here at the Capitol Theater in Madison. And what makes this organ different from one you'd find, you know, when, say, a small community's church or any number of other places, kind of middle-class locations?
Sure. Well, what really distinguishes the theater organ, such as the Barton here at the Capitol Theater, is, first of all, it's located in a theater, and that's not an accident. The purpose of these instruments back in the 1920s, as the silent film era was really coming of age, was to provide this musical accompaniment. To do that, they had to be orchestral instruments, meaning that they had to be able to recreate with pipes. It's a pipe organ, after all. They had to be able to recreate the same sorts of sounds with pipes that you would hear if you were listening to an orchestra. Before these instruments came along, they were primarily orchestras or sometimes pianists in smaller theaters that provided the musical accompaniment. So as a result of that, one of the main differences in what really sets theater organs apart from, say, organs in a church is that they were designed to be orchestral instruments. So you hear a lot more orchestral sounds. You also hear sounds that, for want of a better term, are sound effects, things that you can use if, for example, somebody slips on a banana peel and falls down.
Never happens in silent films.
Never happens. But if it did happen, you'd have a sound effect to use for it. And those sorts of things, those sorts of effects that, on most organs in churches, which are designed primarily for liturgical use, you don't need cymbals and drums and slide whistles and those kinds of effects.
Interesting image conjured there by
right.
it. Well, so what are some of the special effects you have available to you on the Grand Barton organ?
Well, some of the things that I use the most on the Barton here, just to show off a couple, there is something called a Glockenspiel, which is just little bells. So that can be very useful depending on what's going on in the scene. There are also a big bass drum.
Ooh.
And that, again, if somebody slips on a banana peel, you might be able to use that. Also some effects like, for example, tambourines, drums, a little woodblock as well. Huh. So all of those effects... Again, usually you don't use them all at the same time, but when you need to accompany something or really bring out a particular sound effect, those devices are available.
So this kind of organ was developed essentially for playing silent films.
That was their initial use, and again, that is why they are what they are. And as is the case with most musical instruments, that was their original use. Then over the course of the decades and now almost 90 years later, they have become performance instruments in their own right. But it's wonderful to be able to go back to that original use and that originality and use it in the way that it was designed to be used.
Now, many of these films, probably the majority of these silent films, no longer exist.
Unfortunately, that's true.
What about the scores for them, the movie scores, the music scores?
The musical scores, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. There are some films, going back originally to the 20s, sometimes films were released with a full printed score. There are not many of those that still exist. There are some that can still be found today. A lot of times what the studios would release would be like a cue sheet, which just like a single piece or sometimes two pieces of paper with just a single line of music, often drawing from classical music that would have been heard, Rachmaninoff, Schubert, maybe Mozart, Beethoven, what have you. And again, the leitmotif kind of idea. If you look at one of the cue sheets, it might say love theme or heroes theme. Villains theme, that sort of thing. So a lot of times that's what the organists had. Today, a lot of those cue sheets are available, but in many instances they are not available. And when that's the case, it comes down to the creativity of the organist to either compile existing music or create new music, compose new music to that hopefully is in a style that might have been heard back in the 1920s.
So nothing anachronistic in there.
Try not to do any anachronisms, that's right. Basically looking to music that either was heard or would have been heard in, say, 1925 or 1926, or music of a similar style.
Now this movie, The Flying Ace, obviously has aerial scenes. We'll get a little bit later into how those were done, but musically, how do you convey flying?
Musically, there are a couple of different ways to do it. Flying scenes oftentimes entail a lot of action, so sometimes there may be a chase scene involving airplanes. Sometimes it's just simply a shot of an airplane flying across the screen. So a lot of times it's a musical cue, meaning the kind of music that you play may be a little bit more energetic. There may be more of a and, if you will, sort of a chase scene feel to it. There are some ways, and we can do it a little bit on the Barton here, of how to simulate the sound of an airplane. Now, bearing in mind that in the 20s, these were biplanes and propellers and not jet. We weren't to the era of jet aviation yet. But one of the things that I typically do, and I'll give you a little example of it here, when you think about what a propeller sounds like, if you have, sometimes you have multiple propellers or a single propeller, it's sort of that dissonance of the propellers being slightly out of phase. It gives sort of a little bit, almost like a wah-wah sort of effect. Hmm. We can sort of simulate that on the organ by playing two notes that are close together. That sounds something like this. And by changing the pitch, you can sort of simulate the sound of it getting a little faster or getting a little slower.
Yeah. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Jelani Eddington about the art of silent film music. Right after this, you're listening to University of the Air on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with our recent conversation with Jelani Eddington about the art of silent film music.
So,
well, give us a flying scene.
Let's take a look.
Gracious, it's as complicated as all that. I fear I can never learn to fly. Traveling at a speed of 140 miles an hour, the Earth appears to float lazily beneath them from their perch a mile high in the air. For the 100th time, Ruth, I again ask you to marry me. Now, Finley, don't be foolish. For the 100th time, I tell you I'm not sure I'm in love with you. Confound the perversity of woman. The next time I get her in that plane of mine, she'll say yes or get out and walk on a cloud.
Well, things develop very quickly in this first part of the Flying Ace early on, and we're not too sure about this character, Finley, are we, as to whether he's true romantic lead or not, but of course with that wonderful lyrical Rachmaninoff behind the proposal, We give them the benefit of the doubt, maybe.
We do. We do. There are some unanswered questions. Stay tuned.
Now, there are all kinds of film devices already in silent films that we see, and techniques that are used. And what are some of those, and how do you play to them musically?
Well, one of the interesting things is, as with all of silent film accompanying, is to do something musically that is hopefully going to bring out or possibly even make more evident the particular film device that's on screen at the particular point in time. In The Flying Ace, there are a couple of scenes where they do a flashback. So we're in one point in time, sort of in the present point in time, and then as things develop, there's a flashback to a point in time, a previous point in time. And in Flying Ace, they do that through a telescoping effect. You sort of see the scene zoom out and then zoom back in again. And one of the things that is interesting and sometimes a little challenging to do from an accompanying perspective is to play music in a way that is signaling or cueing to the audience that you've got two different timelines going on. So what I try to do sometimes is, for example, if we're playing in the current timeline, playing on a particular sound or at certain groups of stops on the organ, and then as we transition to a different time, a different sounds or a different, either maybe a little quieter or a completely different sound altogether, just to kind of give that contrast between present and past with perhaps louder and softer on the organ.
In this film, The Flying Ace, as you mentioned, there are flashbacks, and one of which is a kind of a setup for the whole crime that's been committed.
Exactly. There's a lot of that mystery that is an undercurrent to the whole film.
Here we go. Let's flashback.
All right, let's have a look.
For your benefit, Mr. Kimball, Mr. Sawtell, and Miss Ruth, I will show you just how this dirty job was pulled off. When Mr. Kimball heard the knock on the door, now, my beauty, you're mine. One little kiss, my sweetie, or you'll get out and walk on a cloud.
One of the things that becomes obvious in watching The Flying Ace is that it was shot in Florida, in Arlington, Florida, where the studio was, the Norman Studio, near Jacksonville. That was kind of the heyday, short as it was, for filmmaking in Florida, wasn't it?
It was, and of course, one of the great attractions to Florida is the weather. And aside from hurricane season, it's sunny there, as opposed to a lot of films at that point were being produced in New York City at that point in time. And New York's weather versus Florida's weather is a little bit of a difference there.
Until a couple of hurricanes came along, and suddenly it was all Hollywood.
Exactly.
How did you get involved with silent films? Do you remember the first one you saw?
I do. I remember seeing many silent films as I was getting involved in theater organ generally. I started my musical career on piano as a pianist. I started that at a young age. I was 4 years old when I started piano lessons.
You and Mozart. Well,
in any event, I hadn't composed symphonies by five, so Mozart takes the cake on that one. But I always had a fondness for music, always had a love of music, and working first with piano. And I had studied piano for a number of years, and I got an opportunity to hear a theater organ in a restaurant down in Indianapolis, Indiana, which is the area that I grew up. And it was a pizza parlor, and there was a large pipe organ, and you could literally sit there and eat pizza and watch all of these wonderful things happening with the organ. It was installed in a way that you could see a lot of the special effects, like the drums, the cymbals, the bell, literally the bells and whistles of the organ. You could see them. And there was even a bumble machine in the dining room, so you could have a slice of pizza with soap suds on it from time to time. So it was really a lot of fun. But that was my introduction to theater organ, and I thought it was just remarkable how a single person could, literally at his or her fingertips, control all of these different musical sounds and devices. And I started to study theater organ, started to do that professionally, and sort of through that vein, obviously discovered the art of silent film and silent film accompanying, and sort of got into it that way.
Do you remember the first couple of films that you saw or played to?
I certainly remember the very first film that I ever accompanied. It was Douglas Fairbanks in The Black Pirate.
Oh.
And I had spent weeks preparing the score, and it came down to showtime, and it was just a few moments before we were going to start the film. And I remember sitting there. It was in a theater. The lights were off. I was down in the orchestra pit. And I realized in those few moments before the film started what a big responsibility it is to have within your own hands, to hold in your hands the musical success of a particular film. Because you start to think about the likes of Douglas Fairbanks or Harold Lloyd, some of the great silent film actors, and the wonderful, amazing careers that they had, and how the success of that particular showing of the film depended in large part on how skilled or sometimes unskilled the accompaniment is. And so I remember in those moments before that first performance, sort of having the veil.
Bad time to have that revelation.
The scales fall from the eyes in that moment, and you realize it's an important contribution to the film.
And the timing, though, is critical. I was going to say first in comedy, but I think also in drama, because if that drum stroke is just half a second too late for the pratfall or whatever it might be, whole different effect.
The goal as an accompanist is, while you're trying to support the film and trying to help develop the film musically, you know you're doing a decent job as an accompanist if the audience forgets about you. So they forget that there's somebody up there actually playing. You're helping to draw them into the film. But one of the things that will destroy that illusion is if you start to miss cues, or if, for example, if we're watching The Phantom of the Opera and the famous scene where the chandelier falls at the Paris Opera House. If you come in with that cue 30 seconds too late, it's obvious to everybody that something has happened. And
It's not just the chandelier that's crashed and burned,
exactly,
it's the whole performance.
Exactly. And it gets the audience thinking about the organist instead of the film. And the primary thing that you can do as an accompanist is to keep the audience engaged with the film.
But you, unlike most contemporary films, which of course have recorded music, you're playing every second of that film, aren't you?
essentially every single second of the film. And some of the films are, you know, there's short films that are 15 or 20 minutes long, but there are some films that are 2 hours, 2.5 hours, 2¾ hours, and that's a long time to play, you know, in a continuous stream. It's amazing, too, thinking about the job of theater organists back in the 20s, because they, you know, the organists that were hired by the theaters would do this all day long, not just the films, not just the feature films, but they would play and accompany newsreels, sometimes vaudeville acts, just basically the musical life of the theater and of the film was literally on the shoulders and in the hands of the organists.
Well, another impressive participant in this phenomenon of the silent film was the stuntman. Where did the stuntmen come from?
Well, stuntmen in the 1920s were the actors themselves. It was a number of years before we saw the phenomenon of stunt doubles. And when you see, it's particularly in films of that era, when you see various feats of gymnastics happening or things that are, you know, sort of make your jaw drop, that's the actor or the actress doing it right there in front of the camera.
There is a remarkable, I don't know if you call him a stuntman per se, but I would, performer in The Flying Ace, goes by the nickname of Peg. He was, I guess, a favorite actor of Richard Norman, but quite the phenomenon. And how do you play a scene, like it's a chase scene in particular that comes to mind in The Flying Ace? How do you play a scene like that?
Well, it's sort of an interesting exercise because it sort of goes back to Richard Norman and his desire of portraying African Americans in such a positive light. In the case of Peg, as we'll see in a few moments, the storyline tells us when we see it that he's come back from the war, the Great War, with an injury as an amputee, and that doesn't stop him, and the film doesn't really focus on that, but that becomes part of what's happening. So you see Peg at various points along the way involved in chase scenes, either on foot or in one particularly memorable scene on a bicycle, trying to manage pedaling a bicycle with, you know, as an amputee and with his crutch on the other pedal, and it's an interesting scene.
Yes, and as I think as you implied, Jelani, with Peg, it's not like they're emphasizing it, it just happens.
It's just very matter of fact.
Just what he does. Wait till you get a load of this.
Let's take a look at it.
By gad, Tucker's plane's on fire.
I'll try that trick at home. What was that you were using for the gunshots there?
So the gunshot effects were used with essentially like big trumpets in the organ. So they were to create sort of a percussive sound. So a big chord just played really loud that punctuates and accentuates through sort of an over the top of the other music that's being played at the time.
Now films today, they have computer generated graphics, can create a crowd as big as you want with a few touches of the button. Surround sound, these wide screens, nuances of color, and of course all the stunt doubles you need. So given that, why do you think silent films are so popular today?
Well, it's amazing to see what they were doing before all of those things were available. And you see some amazing filmmaking, some amazing techniques, and we've talked about some of them today, and it's just a lot of fun to see it. It's a lot of fun to be able to accompany it and, again, try to put that musical soundtrack with it.
And maybe some of those effects, we won't even call them special effects, that they used in the 20s are fresh to us today, not seen, you know, for 75, 85 years.
Very much so.
Some creative thinking there without a lot of technology behind it. Well, speaking of technology, this is a film about flying, The Flying Ace. So it has flying scenes in it. How did they pull those off?
Well, most of the flying scenes themselves were actually shot on the ground. They didn't try to do that in the air. But in the studios, they would do that, and a lot of times using a fan to get the effect of the hair.
Oh, you see a little bit of, like, smoke,
and the smoke
blowing by
exactly,
as clouds, I
exactly,
suppose.
Exactly, to give the effect, you know, of a sort of a sense of realism that this is actually happening, you know, maybe 1,000 feet in the air, as opposed to right there in the studio.
Yeah, there's this one scene in particular in The Flying Ace. It's this kind of daring aerial rescue.
And if you think about, the technology available in the 20s and what would be involved in an aerial rescue. Either on the ground or, you know, heaven forbid, actually in the air. It's an amazing scene, and it's probably one of the most dramatic scenes of the entire film.
And what's the premise here?
The premise is that the love interest, whose name is Ruth, has been captured, if you will, kidnapped, if you will, by Finley, who has her in one plane, and the hero, William Stokes, is in another plane chasing them and is trying to rescue Ruth. And to add a little bit of intrigue to the plot, the plane catches on fire that Ruth and Finley are in. So it's a dramatic scene, and it's a lot of it's very dramatic to watch. It's a lot of fun to play.
Here we go. Aerial rescue.
Fingers crossed.
Not much hope for them now. If I can get above their plane, probably Ruth can catch hold of my rope ladder. Look up, look up, climb, climb, climb.
there's a lot packed into that scene for everybody.
There's a lot going on.
Including you, to keep up with the fire and planes due to crash and people jumping out of planes and people climbing up ladders.
Well, and that's where, as an accompanist, part of what your job is to try to tap into the emotion of a particular scene, and that one is obviously very full of suspense. A lot of things happening, as you say, and so in those kinds of scenes, typically you'll hear the accompaniment get very full, very big, you know, maybe a lot of the bass notes, so that you kind of, not only are you hearing a large crescendo with the organ, but if you're there live in the theater, maybe you even feel the seats start to move under you from all of the big bass pipes as well.
Yeah, we'll talk about surround sound.
Exactly,
you know,
it's the original surround sound.
So you have some kind of a swell on this organ too?
Correct. So the pipes for this organ are installed in what are called chambers, so basically two big rooms on either side of the theater. And if you think about sort of the physics or mechanics of an organ pipe, air goes through the pipe. And when that air goes through the pipe, it sounds at whatever volume it is. It just plays at that volume all the time. So one of the ways that the organist can control the volume or the crescendo is through the use of what are called swell shades, which look like big, almost kind of like, similar to Venetian blinds, but made out of wood. So when they're all closed, they keep all the sound from the pipes inside. So it's quieter in the listening area. As you start to open them, more of the sound can come out. And that's what creates sort of that swell effect from even, you know, using the same pipes playing, they can either be playing a little softer or a little louder. So those are some of the things that the organist has available to make those different effects.
Well, I suppose you would use the swell maybe for a love scene?
You certainly could. Again, it's increasing the intensity of a scene. So an intense emotion could either be fear, it could be love, it could be suspense, it could be any number of things. And you're absolutely right. You could definitely have a swell for any of those, including a love scene.
There are, speaking of love scenes or flirtation scenes, maybe if you want to be a little more accurate at this stage in the relationship, there actually is the most blatant music cue in the whole film comes at a flirtation scene toward the end.
That's right. So at this point, it's just within a minute or so of the end of the picture, and you see the hero, William Stokes, and Ruth, the heroine, you see them come together at the end, and there's a lovely scene where they're sort of flirting with each other as to whether William is going to go back to where he came from or where he's going to stick around a little bit while and try to, you know, see where things go with Ruth. And at that point, as they're flirting back and forth, there is a musical cue that comes on the screen with words for music written by Franz Schubert. And so, which is an actual piece of music.
A famous serenade.
Famous serenade from Franz Schubert. And when you see that sort of cue as an organist, it's telling you something very important. You need to play that piece of music. And this happens in various films. There's one that I can think of where they're all gathered around an organ and they're singing, "Shall We Gather at the River?" If you, on the other hand, play Amazing Grace...
Some people will get it.
It may not be the right musical choice. So that's what happens towards the end of The Flying Ace.
Well, of course, the Schubert Serenade is a fantastic love song anyway.
It's a beautiful piece.
You've covered yourself with glory again, Stubbs. I suppose you will be going back tomorrow? Why, I'm going to stick around here for a day or so after I take the prisoner to the county seat and see if I can detect a way to make Miss Sawtelle let me call her Ruth.
between Schubert and Rachmaninoff there.
Makes for a nice ending.
Makes for a very nice love scene finale to The Flying Ace. We'll get back to our conversation with Jelani Eddington about the art of silent film music right after this. You're listening to University of the Air on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with a recent conversation that I had with Jelani Eddington about the art of silent film music. We were in the Capitol Theater with the grand Barton organ at hand in Madison, Wisconsin. This production of the Norman Studios, one of how many that the studio produced?
They did a number of films. I couldn't give you the exact number, but of the films of this genre, this is probably the one that's the best known. It was one that I had the chance to perform live at the Capitol Theater about a year and a half ago. And again, for all the reasons that we've talked about here today, it was just a terrific experience and something that I'll always remember.
And of those films that they produced, how many do you know have survived?
Unfortunately, there are not as many as we would hope. The Library of Congress has preserved a number of the films, including The Flying Ace. There are unfortunately not that many that survive, you know, intact in their full form. But those that do remain, it's great to be able to preserve them, and then hopefully to have an opportunity like this to be able to play them and accompany them and present them to the public.
And if I remember the story correctly, what Richard Norman did at the end of the silent film era was to invest in sound technology, which proved not to be the chosen one. And then he wound up, I think, going more into the promotional side of the movie industry for the next however many years. But overall, what was the denouement of silent films? What was the time frame we're talking about, beginning to end?
So we're really talking early on, at the earliest outset of it in the early 19-teens through the 1920s. I think of sort of the glory years of silent film being between about 1922-23 through 1929. Some of the biggest and most successful pictures were in that window of time. The denouement, if you will, came around 1929, a picture called The Jazz Singer.
Al Jolson.
And as we talked about a few moments ago, a lot of this evolution is driven by technology, and by 1929, the studios and Hollywood had figured out how to synchronize sound with the picture. And at that point in time, that was a watershed moment, not just for films, but also for the theater organ. It certainly took filmmaking in a different direction, and for all of those organists that had made their careers as accompanists, they suddenly found the industry very much changed, literally overnight. Some of them, in fact, many of them, went on to be successful film scorers in Hollywood, drawing on their experience of doing it all those years in the theater. But that was certainly a watershed moment for the theater organ, and as you know, as is the case with many instruments, the instrument evolved. Unfortunately, there were a lot of theater organs that were lost, as some of the great movie palaces were lost. There are some unfortunate stories about pipe organs that just went down with the theater. You know, nobody even bothered to take the organ out. Fortunately, now looking back on that, you know, there was a big movement starting in around the 1950s and continuing to this day to save not only the theaters but also the theater organs and to help preserve them so that new generations of not just organists but also audience members could enjoy the music and be exposed to what the instruments were. Certainly that's corresponded really well to a resurgence and a renaissance in interest in silent film. And fortunately, there are instruments like this one that are still around where we can really recreate in a very authentic sense what it would have been like in the 1920s to hear and to see pictures like this.
And some of those theater organists, of course, had the advantage of silent films ending at precisely the time that this medium called radio was taking off, so a lot of them found employment there. But, of course, the silent film phenomenon has had this wonderful resurgence, I think because a lot of people have just discovered all these things that are so fresh to us now. And then there's the charm, too, I think, of the live accompanist, the live accompaniment to the film. And maybe it takes a minute, do you think, for the viewer to kind of blend the two together, where they're, you know, for they're seeing a silent film up on the screen, and then they're seeing and hearing an organist over here, and it takes maybe just a minute before those blend, and then for the rest of the film, it's all one big thing.
That's certainly my goal, and those of us who do this, it's always our goal to get the audience more focused on the film than on the organist. And I think you're right. I think it probably just is, because it's such a new thing, and people who haven't ever experienced that may not expect what that's all about, and they may not know what that's all about. But I think within the first few minutes, hopefully, you know, if we're, you know, knock on wood, doing our job the right way, they start to forget about the organist and start to focus on the film. And many times I've had the experience at the end of a film presentation, as the credits are rolling, you have sort of a polite applause from the audience, and then there's this moment, sort of an epiphany moment. Hey, wait a minute, there was somebody that was actually playing music for the last hour and a half. And,
yeah.
And so you kind of see that difference in reaction to the audience, from the audience at the end of a performance. But
status of silent films today, how many of these do you play, and how many of them are going on around the country at any given time, do you know?
Well, as we talked about a moment ago, one of the most gratifying things is there is a real resurgence in interest in silent film as an art form. And that's wonderful for the films, and it's a lot of fun for us as organists as well, because it allows us to do something completely different. I split my time between doing films and doing solo concerts.
Plus you have a day job, I believe.
And I also have a day job as well.
You're an attorney in the Milwaukee area.
I am an attorney in the Milwaukee area, and so there's never a dull moment, let's put it at that. But as far as the music is concerned, it's a very different skill from being a concert organist, where you're really the only thing that's going on and people are focusing on what you're playing, versus being an accompanist where you're trying to focus them on the film instead. But so I split my time musically between those two skill sets, if you will. And I probably within the course of a year may do anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15 silent films in different venues around the country. Certainly the Duck Soup Cinema series in Madison, very, very successful silent film series. And there are others around as well. So it's a lot of fun to be able to do both of those.
Well, Jelani Eddington, thanks for sharing some of the fun with us.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be here, Norman.
Look forward to your next silent film gig.
Thank you.
I talked with Jelani Eddington in the Capitol Theater of Madison's Overture Center for the Arts. Reading our title cards for our silent film, The Flying Ace, was Dom Johnson. Our engineer was Steve Gotcher. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me for the next University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.